Welcome to The Red-Haired Archaeologist. I am your host, author, and sunscreen advocate, Amanda Hope Haley. Thank you for spending some time with me today, studying artifacts our Near Eastern ancestors left behind, and considering if those items just might change how we read or read into scripture. Thank you for bearing with me the last couple of weeks. If you follow me on social media, and if you don't, please do. I'm on Facebook and Instagram. Then you have seen that I have an excavation of my own going on right now. We live in Tennessee, and many years ago, back in 1896, actually, the people who did the development of the neighborhood we live in needed to raise the level where they were going to be doing the building. And so they went to a local foundry and got foundry sand and used that to raise the level of the land so that they could build houses. But the reality of foundry sand is that foundries actually use sand to create molds for things like piping and those gorgeous cast iron tubs. They make molds out of sand, and after they use them a few times, then the molds lose integrity, and so the foundries would just smash them back into sand. Anyway, that sand becomes lead contaminated, as you can imagine. So about 10 years ago, it was discovered that a lot of the properties, not just in my neighborhood, but in a lot of the neighborhoods around us, were contaminated with lead. So the EPA has been working very, very hard to try to fix this. We've actually been on the waiting list for almost 4 years to get our property done. And that finally started about 2 weeks ago. In the middle of all this, I'm also in physical therapy 3 times a week. It's a very busy time. And I got home from physical therapy and got a phone call from the EPA guy that they were going to be coming to our property. So we had to mobilize really quickly and figure that out. And then the reality of it has been, they come in with all this massive equipment. They dig down about 18 inches and keep testing the soil until they get the lead levels to what are acceptable levels. So they did all of that. And everyone who's been here has been great. They dug it out this past week. They refilled with clean soil. And everyone's been wonderful, but it is constant beep, 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 and big crashes as rocks are encountered, as things are dumped into our property. I've been home for all of it because I work from home, obviously, and I record from home in my little closet. I tried recording a couple of weeks ago and it simply wasn't possible. There was no way that Nick was going to be able to get all the background noise out, and it wouldn't have been fair of me to ask him to do that. So I waited for 2 weeks and I've got a little bit batty. All of these noises, I don't know how these guys do it every day. They must have really great noise canceling headphones or something like that, but it's been intense. Our property's been backfilled at this point. Now we're waiting on landscaping and sod, and that's going to be coming in the next couple of weeks. But hopefully things are going to be quieter around here and I'm going to be able to think a little bit more clearly. And we're going to finish up this season of the podcast. After today, I think there will be 3 more episodes to get us through Egypt's history. And as you know, we have been talking about the intersection of Egypt and the Bible. So in our last episode, we left off our discussion around 850 BCE. At that point in your Bible, Israel is divided. There's the northern kingdom that has 10 tribes, and then the southern kingdom, which is made up of Benjamin and Judah. Over in Egypt, a pharaoh named Shoshank I, who the Bible calls Shishak, he made what was really ancient Egypt's last big push for more territory. He's kind of the last pharaoh who really tried to expand the territory and then also the tax base for Egypt. And he went and conquered 120 cities in the nations surrounding him. Several of those were in the Levant. He didn't conquer Jerusalem, but he did end up taking a large amount of tribute from Jerusalem's temple and the palace. And this took place just after the split between northern and southern Israel. So as we talked about last week, at this time period, Egypt is in what we call the third intermediate period. Most of the pharaohs during this time are not native-born Egyptians. Shoshank was actually Libyan by birth, and for literally the next 200 years, there's going to be very, very few Egyptian pharaohs. This may be part of the reason Egypt really started to decline. From places like Libya, and later on we're going to mention Nubia as well, You had princes in these territories who would gather power among their people, and then they would rise up and attempt to conquer other areas of Egypt and become the pharaohs of Egypt themselves. This obviously worked out for some of them. But the result is 200 years of just instability, because Egypt is constantly at war within itself. So while ancient Egypt is trying to hold itself together and hold on to its power, up in the north, there is a new empire that is starting to gather strength in the region. And this is the Neo-Assyrian Empire. Most people will refer to it as the Assyrian Empire. In reality, this was sort of the second Assyrian Empire, and that's why we call it Neo-Assyrian. The word Neo simply means new. In 722, the northern kingdom of Israel fell to the Neo-Assyrians. The two men who spearheaded that were Shalmaneser V and Sargon II. They went into the capital city of the northern kingdom, which was Samaria, and they conquered it. The Assyrians did what all empires really up until that time did in order to control it. They would go in and they would take the leaders of wherever they had conquered, in this case, Samaria, and move those people into different parts of the Assyrian Empire. At the same time, they would take people from other parts of the Assyrian Empire and move them into, in this case, the city of Samaria. And so this was done to keep people from being able to rebel against their new leaders, against their new overlords. As a side note, this event is how we, quote unquote, lost 10 of the tribes of Israel. Politically speaking, the people of northern Israel were spread out throughout the empire, so they lost a lot of their continuity. And then the people who moved back in, some Israelites would have remained in Samaria, but then you had all of these other people from other traditions coming and moving in. And over time, the Samarians would come to be known as the Samaritans. So when you're reading in the New Testament about Samaritans, keep this history in the back of your mind as to who they are. In 722 and later, Shalmaneser, Sargon, the leaders of the Neo-Assyrian Empire, take the northern kingdom. They make a go at getting the southern kingdom, but Judah escapes the fate of the northern kingdom at this point by agreeing to pay really heavy taxes to the Assyrians. This is sort of what they did to get out from underneath Shoshank. This is really common at the time. You have empires coming in. Sometimes empires will completely consume cities and make them part of the empire. And sometimes the generals and the political leaders who are in charge decide, you know what? I'll just take all of your money and that's going to be enough for me. The northern kingdom, the very worst happened for them. The southern kingdom got away with paying insanely high taxes to them. So while all of this is happening in Israel, down in Egypt, they have their first Nubian ruler. It's the year 690, and the man who comes to power is named Taharqa. He is mentioned in the Bible. You find him in 2 Kings 19:9, and he is described as Taharqa, Cush's king. There's a slightly different spelling there. It's a result of transliteration, but that's who we're talking about. He is the pharaoh. He goes up from Egypt toward Assyria and attempts to attack Assyria from the south. And the Bible describes this was actually done at the request of King Hezekiah in Judah. Unfortunately, Egypt loses. Assyria gets really, really mad at Egypt for Egypt coming and getting involved in all of these skirmishes. And so Assyria turns their attention and starts moving south. They end up attacking Egypt directly. And so about 25 years later, it takes some time for Assyria to conquer everything and move down into Egypt. But in 664, Assyria ends up making it all the way to the capital at Memphis. They get in there, they take the bounties from Egypt the same way that they had been taking them from Judah. They exported a lot of Egyptian officials into other parts of Assyria. So same thing that happened to the northern kingdom is now starting to happen in Egypt. And then down in Egypt, Assyria didn't really move people into Egypt, but they did choose a puppet king. And so for a brief period of time, you actually see native Egyptian pharaohs again, but they have been put in power by the Assyrians. The first one is a man named Necho I. Over the time that he was ruling Egypt, he endured some civil wars, some attacks from Taharqa, and periodically the Assyrians would have to come back down into Egypt and put down all these little rebellions that were going on. The Assyrian Empire as a whole had a lot of power for about 300 years, but they weren't actually in Egypt that long. They were really there for about 60 years, and obviously at the end of their empire. As Assyria, as it got so large, the larger something is, the harder it is to keep control of. And so as Assyria's growth starts to slow, they are encountering another neo-empire, the Neo-Babylonian Empire. So it's been about two generations of Assyrian rule in Egypt, and Necho I's grandson is now on the throne. He is Necho II. We actually learn about him from the Bible too. He is mentioned in 2 Kings 23. As Assyria and Babylonia are coming into conflict with each other, it's unsurprising that Egypt would head up and be on Assyria's side, because Egypt is part of the Assyrian Empire, definitely a vassal state. And as we've talked about a lot this season, the Egyptians are strong, powerful, mighty warriors. At the very least, Assyria would have wanted to use them as mercenaries. In 2 Kings 23, we get what is sort of a strange story on its surface. The year would have been 609 BCE. Necho II is on his way north to enter into the fight between Assyria and Babylonia. And so in order to do that, obviously, he had to cross through the Levant. And so he came into conflict with the king at the time, Josiah. Josiah, who happened to be the grandson of Hezekiah. So Necho is crossing through Josiah's territory. And Josiah's not happy about this. He goes out and he meets him and tries to stop him. This does not go well for Josiah. This does not go well for the kingdom of Judah. Necho kills Josiah, and then Judah ends up becoming a vassal state of Egypt this time. Within 3 months, Necho imprisons and then eventually deports Josiah's son and heir. He massively taxes Judah, as you would expect. And he puts his own puppet king on the throne, a man named Jehoiakim. He ends up ruling for 11 years, but during those 11 years, Jehoiakim's loyalties are going to end up shifting to Babylonia. In fact, that only takes about 3 years, because in 605, Necho ends up encountering Nebuchadnezzar, who of course was the head of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. They meet at the Battle of Carchemish, and Egypt loses, and they lose badly. So badly that the Babylonians end up pushing them all the way back into the African continent. Nebuchadnezzar does attempt to actually take Egyptian land in 601, but he was still pushed out, and he ends up getting returned to Babylon, which is the capital city of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Even though Egypt ends up getting thoroughly trounced by Babylonia, Judah was still holding on. They, for several years, were still just a vassal state until 590. And in 590, Judah's king Zedekiah decided that he was sick of paying all this money to Babylonia, and he got some of his administrators and military leaders to start writing letters to a pharaoh in Egypt. The Bible calls him Hophra. The Egyptian records call him Apries. We have copies of these letters. They're probably copies. We probably don't have the originals. They are referred to today as the Lachish letters because they were found at Tel Lachish. What we have are some large and some small fragments of broken pottery that have these letters written on them. The result of this request for help from Zedekiah is that Egypt's involvement didn't really help that much, because Judah and Jerusalem fall to Babylonia in 586 BCE. That is when the temple is razed, the entire city is upended, burned to the ground. So after 586, Babylonia did what the Assyrians did before them and other empires even before that. They took the most powerful people within Judah, exiled them throughout the Babylonian Empire, but they did allow some apolitical natives to remain there. One of those natives who stayed was a man named Gedaliah. He was appointed to govern Judah, but was required to remain loyal to Babylonia. Pretty quickly, he ends up getting killed by a group of Judahite loyalists who were still living there. And then those loyalists end up fleeing to Egypt. In the Bible, the prophet Jeremiah talks about this, and he is not happy about this. He tells the Judahites that any of the people who flee to Egypt, they are doing so against God's will, and they are going to die. So around 580, for whatever reason, the Judahites who go down into Egypt, they actually take Jeremiah with them. And sadly, he ends up dying in Egypt himself. We can't know exactly who all of those people were or exactly where they went to based on the biblical narrative. But in Egypt, right at the right time, actually during the time when King Josiah was in power, a city was growing up in Egypt called Elephantine. At Elephantine, the Judahites who went down there ended up building a temple and worshiping there. If you know a little bit about the history of King Josiah, one of the things that was really important to him was to go into all of the cities of Judah and make sure that people were not worshiping God anywhere other than the temple. In the Bible, you have descriptions of things called high places, where prior to the temple being built in Jerusalem, people would worship God there. They weren't illegal at that point. They don't really become illegal until Solomon builds the temple. But over time, and especially with the split between the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom, people, for whatever reason, ceased traveling to Jerusalem to worship God properly, and they would worship in other places. This becomes a problem in places like the Northern Kingdom, where other cultures are coming together, in cities like Elephantine that had not just former Judahites living there, but also a lot of Greek immigrants were living there at the same time. Anytime there is a high place where there is worship happening outside of Jerusalem, that worship ends up getting blended with other traditions and other cultures and even other religions. That is really Josiah and, of course, God's major problem with these kinds of locations. For an empire such as Babylonia that has a really huge place in human history, you may be surprised to know that it didn't actually last for very long. The Babylonian Empire only ruled, if you will, for about 70 years, from 609 to 539 BCE. At that point, Cyrus II, who had founded the Persian Empire, he ends up coming into contact with the final king of Babylon, Nabonidus, in 539, and he conquers them. And so what was the Babylonian Empire, whoosh, overnight, politically speaking, becomes the Persian Empire. It actually took Egypt about 6 years to really feel this regime change. Cyrus II eventually sent his own son, Cambyses, down into Egypt to try to conquer it more officially. So in 525, a pharaoh named Psammeticus III ends up losing to Persia at the Battle of Pelusium. Cambyses ends up getting all the way into the capital at Memphis, lays siege to it, and he kills that last pharaoh, who was a native Egyptian who had been put in power by the Assyrians. The Persian Empire lasts a little bit longer than the Neo-Babylonians did. They actually make it about 200 years. And they organize things a little bit differently than the people did before them. Instead of going into Egypt and setting up their own pharaoh there, the heads of the Persian Empire declared themselves the pharaohs of Egypt. And then they would put a person in charge that would be called a satrap. Under the Persians, Egypt becomes a satrapy. It's a funny word, satrapy, which is a lot like a province. I'm bringing this word up because you're going to be hearing it a lot next week because the Greeks do the exact same thing. A lot of what we know about the way the Persian Empire operated in Egypt comes from a very famous historian named Herodotus. He is the one that told us that Darius took on that pharaoh mantle for himself, and that Darius was actually a really big supporter of Egypt's religious cults. He sent money into Egypt to add on to their temples, and he encouraged the people to continue worshiping their gods as they had before. If this sounds familiar to you at all, that's because this is exactly what he did for Jerusalem. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah are all about the rebuilding of Jerusalem, the temple, the city itself, under the Persian Empire. Whereas the Babylonians and the Assyrians before them looked at the people they conquered and went, in order to keep control, we have to completely decimate their culture. The Persians said, hey, let's just blend these cultures. Let's allow people to continue living their lives the way that they did before. Let's keep them happy. And in that way, let's keep our power. So this is a marked change. And maybe this is part of the reason that the Persian Empire hung around so much longer than the Babylonian Empire did. As a result of these policies, the Persian Empire really had very little effect on Egyptian culture as a whole. When Darius I comes in, he did some really great things for them. For instance, he is the one who finished a canal linking the Nile to the Red Sea. This was huge for Egypt. It really increased their capacity to trade easily with, well, primarily Persia. It would have been faster for them to cross over the Red Sea and get to Persia. So, you know, yeah, Persia probably did it for their own self-interests. But it was good for Egypt as a whole for the future, too, to have those kinds of canals built. But all was not bliss for the Egyptians. No one wants to be under the thumb of another empire. And so in 332, the Egyptians would welcome in someone that they thought was going to be a savior for their people. That was a man named Alexander. Join me next week. We're going to pick up talking about Alexander and how this one man who the Egyptians thought were going to give them back their culture and their country actually does exactly the opposite. And we are about to see the ancient Egyptian culture give way to the Greek way of life. The Red-Haired Archaeologist podcast is researched, hosted, and recorded by me, Amanda Hope Haley. It is sound edited by Nicholas Allaire. New episodes are released each Thursday. To interact with me and other listeners, make sure you click the follow button on the Red-Haired Archaeologist pages on Facebook and Instagram. Then check out my website at redhairedarchaeologist.com, where you can subscribe to my monthly email and book me to come speak in your town.